Du lyssnar på Microsoft Partnerpodden.
En teknikstrategisk podd för dig i IT-branschen.
Med mig, Adam Palm.
Och mig, Johan Nordberg.
All right, allesammans. Hej och välkomna tillbaka. Johan, vi har ju en riktig GitHub-bonanza nu.
Ja.
Det man inte vet är att idag, just den här dagen, då spelar vi in faktiskt två stycken avsnitt av podcasten. Varav båda två, på något sätt handlar om GitHub.
Det kan vara mitt fel.
Lite förkärlek för GitHub.
Det kan vara så, precis. So the guest today, Adam was just explaining in Swedish that you are actually our second guest today from GitHub. It might have something to do that me as a developer almost find GitHub more exciting than Microsoft at the moment because you're doing so much cool stuff. So the background is that I've held a lot of... let's back up for a minute. Who are you? And welcome to the show, Greg. I just forgot to introduce you all along. Welcome to the show, Greg. Who are you and what do you do?
Hey there, I am T. Greg Doucette. I'm with GitHub's commercial legal team. So we are the folks who negotiate contract terms. We write the template terms for the different products and services. And that is my role. So I am a former developer. I was not good at being a developer. And so because of that, out of the teams that I was on, I worked for Apple for a stretch. I worked for a bunch of startups. I kept getting shifted to kind of a technical writer role, you know, go add comments to the code, go write the manual, do the presentations to LT. And so I decided that after a few years of that, that was not fun. It was not what I went to college for. I have a degree in computer science and was not using it and decided to go to law school. So I ran my own law firm for 10 years. And then this spot opened up at GitHub. And now I'm kind of closing the loop, coming back where I can actually use my legal skill in a development environment.
Yeah, this might actually be the first and probably the only time where I'm really, really excited to be talking to a business lawyer.
That's not the first time I've heard that. Yeah. We get that quite a bit, yeah.
How long have you been at GitHub?
So I've been at GitHub for a year and a half, so almost 2 years. What we call them are Harborversaries. My two-year mark will be in June, so I just got a few more months to go.
All right.
During the time As you mentioned, you had your own firm. Did you do a lot of IT-related?
No, I did almost nothing IT. I ran my own IT. So, like, I handled my network. I handled our email servers and everything else. But most of my stuff was related to business litigation. And, you know, someone broke a contract or wants to deal with a non-compete clause or something like that. And then I had a separate area of practice where we did a lot of stuff around the First Amendment in the United States. So the ability to protest the government, I defended protesters. If someone filed a lawsuit claiming someone had defamed them, most of the time it's not actually defamation, so I would defend those folks. But most of it was business. And that was how I got into the door at GitHub, because they needed a business lawyer. Since we're writing the contracts, it helps to know if something goes wrong, how would a hypothetical customer file a lawsuit against GitHub? The fact that I had the developer background didn't come up until later, because it turns out, you know, years back, for example, GitHub has the Arctic Code Vault, where all of the public code in our repos is now stored in the Arctic somewhere. I've got code in that vault. You can go see it. I have the little badge and everything. It's not good code, but it's in there.
But it's there.
Yeah. So, I recently listened to a webinar with you, and I thought you were excellent. And I, especially this last quarter, I do a lot of GitHub Copilot workshops and hackathons. And there are a couple of questions that always tend to come up. And some of them are straight up questions, and some are more like worries. So I thought that instead of someone trusting a random dude like me, how about inviting you to who actually know this stuff for real to get us to help straighten some of these things up? So can you guess what the first question or most common question could be?
So the most common question I get is, are we GDPR compliant? How are we dealing with their data?
That is definitely one of my list, yes.
Oh, that was not your first one? Well, I want to know what your first one was.
The first one I always seem to get, especially from developers, is, are you using my code or my repo for training the model?
Training the model, yeah. Okay, so in terms of the answer to that question, it's going to be very long and convoluted. It depends, because that is the lawyer answer to
that. That sounds
everything.
Like a Microsoft answer as
If you have a public repository and you had code that was sitting in that public repository as of the date when the training cutoff was for these particular models, the answer is probably yes. Your code has been used. The key difference is that's public repos that are available to everybody. That's usually why you put them in a public repo. That is different from what you are using when you are actively using Copilot, what we call your prompts that you use to get a response back, and the suggestions being the responses themselves. For that, the baseline is that we do not use any of your stuff for training the models. Essentially, what happens is that these models get trained by OpenAI. They are given to Microsoft essentially as a sealed black box that we interact with via API. And that's it. Like, we can fine tune our models ourselves because Copilot is enabled by default for everyone at GitHub and everyone at Microsoft. But that foundation model, that black box that we get from OpenAI, isn't touched. We don't change that. We don't retrain it. We don't take people's prompts and retrain it. Your stuff that you are typing in to the Copilot editor is not going to be used for model training.
So there's a checkbox for the individual Copilot licenses that says something like, do you allow us to use your data to improve our product or our something like that, which I know is not there for the business and enterprise SKUs. Can you explain a little bit the differences between individual licenses and business licenses here?
Yep. So with Copilot for individuals, the assumption is that you're not tied to any corporate environment. You're not using this for professional work. You're using it for hobbyist type things. A lot of GitHub users have one account that they use for both things, but we also have users that will create multiple accounts, one for kind of their personal, you know, like open source contributions versus what they're using for their job. And so for Copilot for individuals, you can choose whether you want to share your code with us or not. And in that type of scenario, as we're aggregating that information, both from the Copilot for individuals users and internal use, so like internal GitHub and Microsoft employees, their prompts get logged as well. All of this massive stuff, we can then use to fine tune our own model. So that is an option for Copilot for individuals users to choose whether or not they want to do that. That is not an option if you're using Copilot Business or Copilot Enterprise. That tick box does not exist. It is turned off by default. The only time your prompts can be used for model training, if you're using one of those products, is if the company gets what we call a custom private language model. So kind of like a fine-tuned model, but specific to a particular customer. In that scenario, it's a whole separate product they have to get. The enterprise allows us to log those prompts to help produce something better tailored to those particular users. But just as a baseline, Copilot for Business, Copilot for Enterprise, there is no option for you to allow us to keep your stuff. We just don't keep it by default. Because frankly, we don't want it. Like, I'm sure all the code is great, but it becomes a security risk for us if we have companies, you know, trade secrets just sitting at rest somewhere on our servers. And so it's better for the customer that they don't have their IP out there. It's better for us that we're not taking on that risk.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think it's good to know that as an individual, it's literally just a checkbox that you can opt in or out if you don't want to be a part of this. It's like, go to your settings, Copilot, and uncheck a checkbox. It's not harder than that. Yeah. So the second one is actually the one that you started with. Are my code sent to the United States, or does it stay within the EU, for instance? And is code even like considered like personal information?
Right. So that there it gets very complicated depending on what you're doing. So GitHub Copilot was engineered toward GDPR compliance first. So we have to comply with privacy laws everywhere that we operate, but GDPR is so comprehensive and so far ahead of other countries that if we're compliant with that, that makes us compliant with most other countries' laws as well. So when you're using Copilot, think of it in kind of three different buckets of data that get generated. The prompts are your inputs to the model. Most of the time, there is no personal data there. You can choose to put personal data in your code if you want to put in someone's real name or address. Like, it's a bad idea. You should always be using dummy data when you're doing development. But some folks don't necessarily do that. But normally, code is not personal data. The suggestions that come back to you, the outputs, are not personal data. And then we have a third bucket that we call user engagement data. This is kind of like the telemetry. You know, when did your session start? When did it end? That is personal data because we use what we call pseudonymous identifiers to help partially mask the ID. So it's not directly traceable back to a customer unless you combine it with another data set that normally GitHub would not have. So just to give you an example, if you had a random pseudo ID of like, you know, AB123F, that pseudo ID will be used for your different interactions with Copilot. And we can't tell by default who that is. But if your company's single sign-on logs had, you know, Adam logging in from 3 to 3:30 local time, and you see in the user engagement logs that AB123F is logged in from 3 to 3:30 local time, if you combine those data sets, it's possible to reverse engineer that pseudo ID is Adam. So it's not anonymous, it's only pseudonymous. And because of that, we have to comply with all the GDPR requirements around personal data. So to do that, we do a few things. One, the actual pseudonymization is actually part of the GDPR things. If you can't fully anonymize it, at least pseudonymize it, so you're doing data minimization. We also encrypt everything end-to-end. So it's going over HTTPS using TLS 1.2 or 1.3. With respect to your prompts and suggestions, that data never gets stored at rest. It's only processed ephemerally in RAM. And then once it's processed, it gets deleted during garbage collection. For user engagement data, it does get stored at rest, but it's got strong encryption and everything else to help minimize the chance of a data leak. Now, where that data goes is a bit of a "it depends" type question. Because what we do is GitHub Copilot uses Azure Traffic Manager in performance mode. And so it's going to route your data to one of four different Azure zones, depending on what is going to provide the lowest latency. So we have zones in France, Switzerland, the United States, and Japan. So by default, for most European Union customers, most of the time, you're either going to be in that France or Switzerland zone. It's never going to leave the European boundary, but it can. So it's possible that if there's something going on in Europe, you know, there's a DDoS attack or something like that, if there's really high latency for the Europe zones, it will be dynamically routed to the US or theoretically to Japan. So as part of that aspect of it, we have our what we call our customer security and trust team. We work on these transfer impact assessments, the things that are required under GDPR to assess the data risk. We also, within our data protection agreement, lay out how we protect customers' data. And we have also self-certified under the US-EU data privacy framework to help address that stuff as well. So we do everything we can to protect customers' data by default so that we don't have to worry about any risk. We do data minimization. We do privacy by design. But there are times where your stuff could leave Europe. And in that type of scenario, we've got fallback options to help make sure your data is still protected and you're legally compliant.
Yeah, and I think that's the key thing, right? That you still are compliant even if the data would be outside of Europe. It's exactly still right. Within the boundaries of what is legal. And I know I said it like a gazillion times in this podcast, but, you know, being Microsoft or GitHub or any like really big American corporation, like the business runs on trust. And if you're not sure, I mean, follow the money. We don't afford to be reckless with customer data because that would be end of business.
Exactly right. Yeah. When I say that to folks, they don't believe me because they're like, you're a lawyer. What did, you know, I can't trust a lawyer. And I'm like, okay, don't trust me for the sake of trusting me. Trust me for the sake of, if I'm lying to you, you can sue us. Like that's you know, we don't want to deal with the lawsuits. So we're going to do what we're telling you we're doing.
Yeah. And you mentioned one thing on the webinar I watched that you are, GitHub is using GitHub Copilot themselves. So whatever you, however you would treat your customers, you're treating yourself the same way. So I'm pretty sure you don't want your stuff leaked as well. So that is also quite a good indicator
exactly right.
that someone's eating their own dog food.
Yes, we do everything. It's weird coming as a lawyer. Like, we build GitHub on GitHub. Yeah. We use the GitHub repositories. We use issues for tracking. Copilot is enabled for everybody by default. I, as a lawyer, a non-developer, have a Copilot account. And it's weird because I can actually do demos. If you ever want to like surprise somebody, send in a lawyer who runs a demo. But yes, we're in the same boat as our customers on this because it helps us save time. But we also have the same worries that customers have because we don't want our stuff, you know, leaking out somewhere.
Yeah. When you enter something in Copilot and it suggests something, is the data like cleaned in some way on the way up and on the way down? What happens there?
Yep. So how it happens is going to depend on what you're using. So for what I'm going to do is let me narrate kind of the world of Copilot stuff and then the two methods that you're using for different things. So the auto completion function, code complete, that's been around for almost 2.5 years now. So it was the Copilot for Individuals version of it was released in the summer of 2021. And the way that is set up, the data flow starts from your machine, goes to what we call the Copilot proxy service, where we do pre-processing on the inputs and post-processing on the outputs. Then it goes to the language models that are hosted by Microsoft. And then the data comes back down the other direction, back through the proxy, then back to the end user. That's for the code complete functionality that most people think of when they talk about Copilot. There's a bunch of other stuff that's come out in the past 6 months. Copilot chat, Copilot for the command line interface, Copilot for repositories, where essentially you have chat running in your web browser. All of those things use a similar setup, but a different path to do it. We use what is called the Copilot API or CAPI. So the data goes from your end user to CAPI to the service and back down. And so CAPI is a lot more expansive. It enables things like interacting with, you know, extra extensions. So like the Bing extension, Copilot chat can interact with Bing to get information, and then Bing can help send that stuff back. There's a lot of really cool stuff happening there, but the mechanism for doing it is different. So I got to give you that preface as the lawyer to know that what you're doing is going to depend on how you're doing it, essentially. For the code completion, what would happen is that as you're doing your prompt, we've got it set up so that the extension on your local machine in your code editor is going to produce we have a set thing called the prompt library. It's going to craft a prompt in one of two scenarios. Either you stop typing because we're assuming that you want a suggestion at that point, or use a particular keyboard shortcut to force Copilot to produce a prompt. And so what that's going to do is that's going to take what we call an initial code window. So think of it as a few lines before and after your cursor. From that, there's logic in the extension that basically parses that to see if other open tabs might have relevant info. So the most common use case is unit tests. You've got the unit test being written in one tab, the class you're testing is in another. The Copilot extension is smart enough to piece those together. So it'll take some from what you're doing actively, some from the class that's being tested, merge those two into part of your prompt. That prompt gets transmitted to the proxy service. And so what's happening at that point is two things. One, we run what is called an intent classifier, trying to figure out, is this code that you're asking for? If it is, what type of code is it? Is it a test? Is it a method? Is it a class? And then we also have a filter from Microsoft's Office of Responsible AI that is designed to screen out bad stuff, stuff that is either not coding related or it's coding related, but it's illegal. So if you're trying to ask Copilot for tips on how to hack into the Central Intelligence Agency, the filter will flag that and the prompt just gets ignored. It passes silently. You shouldn't get a response back. Once that's done, those two filters get run. The prompt then gets re-encrypted and sent to the models. And the models are going to spit out an array of up to 10 suggestions. And so that array construct, I realize this is a code-oriented podcast, so folks probably already know this, but just think of the array as an egg carton. The suggestions are the individual eggs. Comes back to the proxy service for post-processing. And at that point, we run five different filters. So we run the same two from before, this intent classification, are we actually giving you code? We run the responsible AI filter, making sure that we're not accidentally giving you instructions on how to hack the Central Intelligence Agency. Then we run a limited scrub for certain types of things that look like personal data. So like we scrub out email addresses, because one of the things with language models, they're predicting one token at a time. As part of that, they hallucinate. They fabricate things that don't exist. So it will spit out emails or certain URLs that look real but are not. And so we try to catch those and scrub those out. We also run a filter to look for the most common vulnerable coding patterns. So SQL injections, path injections, things like that. If we catch one of those, the suggestion gets deleted from the array. And then we have what we call the duplicate detection filter, which is the main thing that customers rely on to ensure that the code they're getting is good to include in their code base. So what the duplicate detection filter does is first thing it's going to do is on every single suggestion, we delete all the white space. So remove the spaces, remove the tabs, remove the carriage returns, because none of that matters for compiling your code. Taking what's left, we're doing a comparison on lexemes. So think of a lexeme as a thing. It is a unit of the thing family. The assignment operator, the equal sign, that's one lexeme. The comparison operator, two equal signs, that is still one lexeme. A variable name is one lexeme regardless of how long or short the variable name is. And so taking the suggestions, comparing it against the code index that GitHub maintains. So we scan every single public repository because we use that just for our generic code search that people love. We're comparing against that index. And if what's in the suggestion matches something in the index at a length of 65 lexemes or longer, so that on average comes out to about 150 characters. If you have that match, everything from the match onward gets deleted from that particular suggestion. So most of the time, the whole suggestion is thrown out because a lot of suggestions just tend to be short based on how people use the service. But if you had a longer suggestion, the unique bits would stay and then everything that is a duplicate gets deleted. So after we've run those five filters, whatever is left in the array gets transmitted to the end user and shows up in your code editor as a possibility. So we have a lot of different filtering mechanisms to try and provide you clean, usable code. They're not perfect, and that's something I got to emphasize. You still need a developer there to help vet the results. You know, we tell folks it's Copilot, not Autopilot. There has to be somebody making sure that it's bug-free, it does what you want, you know, it compiles. But we do everything we can on our end to try and help make sure you have good results sent back to you.
When you describe, like Greg, you know, all the stuff that happens, two things strikes me. One, the response, if someone were to, if you had no clue and you would ask, you know, what would be the average response time of those actions? It feels like that should be like 30 minutes, right? So it's amazing how actually fast it does the
Yeah, it is not. It's very quick.
Yeah. That's just that is amazing. But also everything that's goes on behind the scenes. Just look, if that were to be a manual process, you know, the time it would take to execute all those things, the amount of help you get in that period of time is nothing short of amazing, I think.
Exactly right. And part of that is the benefit of us running on Azure, because Microsoft has built this Azure infrastructure worldwide that is designed to be responsive and fast. All of Copilot end-to-end runs within that Azure bubble. So it is coming from your end user's machine to a GitHub run Azure tenant to Microsoft's Azure service hosting the models back to the Azure tenant, it's able to be super quick. We have a time budget, and it's changed. Like, it's gotten short over time, so I don't actually know what it is now. It used to be like 100 milliseconds or less to get from when you stop to when you get the first prompt back. It's an incredible amount of compute happening to have that done quickly and to get you good results in the process. It's amazing.
It really is. And actually, I almost started laughing when you said that it tries really hard to not give me vulnerable code or something like hacking the CIA, for instance. I recently sat and created like a demo repo to show off GitHub Advanced Security because I'm doing a demo on that soon. So I asked Copilot, like, can you please give me code that does this thing that is bad? And it just wouldn't let me. It's like, it can help me with a lot of things, but it can't help me, even when I specifically ask it for, so can you please do it's this and include some, even either like a CWE known vulnerability, or just like say, write some code with a SQL injection vulnerability. And it's like, nope, won't do that.
Yeah, we're always trying to find a balance because like there's a lot of dual use technology. Like we need security researchers to see this stuff to know that it's vulnerable. Yeah. But at the same time, you know, it's a shared responsibility model and our responsibility is not making code actively worse. So we just completely shut that off as an option. You're going to have to create your injection vulnerabilities yourself.
And actually, that is something that I noticed was very different between GitHub Copilot and ChatGPT. Because I can get help, so to say, from ChatGPT to give me examples of these kind of codes. And I needed to, like, as always, phrase the prompt a little bit different than, hey, give me some dangerous code. It was more like, hey, I'm doing this project and I want to showcase how this can be bad. Can you please show me an example of how the bad code could look and how I can fix it to make it safe? Then it was able to help me. So you need like a little bit of tricks there. that's kind of funny.
Now, so you mentioned advanced security. One of the interesting things that's going to be coming out soon is what we call advanced security code autofix, where it will actually go through your code and find the vulnerabilities and provide patches. So you can actually patch code very quickly. And that relies on Copilot technology. So it's really cool stuff happening in that space.
It can, CodeQL can find a vulnerability and almost like create a pull request to hear how to fix it.
To patch it. Yep.
That's amazing. Yeah, and Dependabot to fix vulnerable dependencies. That works really well. So that would be super interesting to see. And you almost, or completely maybe, answered one of the other questions that I often get, and that is, what happens if Copilot gives me copyright protected code? And it sounds like you say, so it won't.
Generally, yes. And so that we're getting into, this is like in the weeds, lawyerly stuff. So whether or not any particular code is copyrighted, it's very hard to get copywritten code, just in general, because under United States copyright law and the copyright laws of a lot of other jurisdictions, code cannot be protected. You can't get any IP protection for it if it's too short, if it's purely functional and doesn't represent any creative process. There's a list of things in code that just cannot be protected. You can't own it. You can't license it. It's free for everybody to use. And that was something that, you know, the legislators decided we want to have so that people can create new things with this tool. And so a lot of times when people talk about copyright violations, they just kind of say it, but it's not really a thing in the code world. Now, it's different if you're using natural language outputs like ChatGPT, or if you're using kind of audiovisual stuff like Midjourney, Stable Diffusion. That's a very different situation. And I am not equipped to kind of to give opinions on that, because a lot of people have very sincere beliefs on just the theory of how copyright is supposed to work.
Yeah, but I in think the code, like, sorry, ahead. I just because I think that's super interesting. Let's say you use some sort of AI to produce, let's say, a song, a music, like who owns the intellectual property that's getting produced. I think that's, you know, one of the big things that needs to be sorted out sometime in the future.
That's going to be one of the hot topics. You know, you look, for example, at the United Kingdom, they explicitly allow AI created works to be registered for copyright. Whereas in the United States, we do not. If it's created solely by machine, you cannot get any intellectual property protection in it. Yep. Now, if it's just what we call AI assisted, not AI generated, but AI assisted, that's different. And so in that type of scenario, you can get protection for the total compilation, so like your end software package, but you have to disclaim the parts that the AI gave you, because our Copyright Act only protects human creation, not machine creation. So it's just a very, just from a baseline, it's very difficult to get code that is copyrighted, that's long enough and creative enough that you could theoretically file a lawsuit over it.
I didn't now, even know that that existed. I'm sorry, yeah. I didn't know that you that existed something that was that you could copyright code.
Yeah, it's everyone tries. So like you look, for example, at Microsoft. When we release a new version of Windows, we will file a copyright for the Windows compilation. It just happens that within that code base, huge chunks of it are not actually protected. And so if there was a situation where someone was basically creating a duplicate of Windows, if we wanted to try and file some type of claim against them for that, you can do it. It's just very difficult because you got to have experts to go through the different sets of code and see if what's being done actually replicates what you have. So copyright usually is not a good way to protect code. People just kind of do it because that they've always done it.
Would it almost be
the stronger ways to do it?
Would it be easier to copyright the UI of Windows than the actual code running Windows?
Yeah. So typically what we do is that, at least in the United States, and I don't know European Union law on this, but typically that would be what's called a trademark or trade dress, kind of your look and feel, which is a different area of the law. And so with that, that usually is something that you can do if it creates customer confusion. So if you have protected this particular user interface, someone has created a knockoff, and customers are legitimately confused. They think they're using Windows when they're not. That type of basis, you can actually get, you know, you can sue somebody for it and win.
Yep.
A lot of times also you'll see it done through just normal contract terms. So your terms of use, terms of service, often will include a clause that says you can't duplicate, reverse engineer, copy, these types of things. And in that type of scenario, usually that works as well. So what we tell folks is that when you're thinking about your concern with copyright, think of it along the lines of a cake. So three-layer cakes are super common, and we call this kind of a three-layer, you know, IP risk assessment framework. The base layer is the law, because for most of the outputs you're going to get, they're not protected. It's too short to be protected, or it's purely functional. There is no creative human creativity there. And so what you're getting from the machine is that, because what these language models are doing is, as part of the training data, they're doing pattern recognition. And for you to have code that is so common, so ubiquitous, that it becomes a pattern, that type of stuff typically is not protected because it's universal. Everybody does it. So like, use the example, initializing a loop, you know, for int I equals zero, I less than x, I plus plus. You can't copyright that. You can't patent that. You can't trademark that because everybody does it. Yeah. And so from a baseline, the laws that exist today on training the language models, using the language model, protects customers, at least in the code context. Now, like I said, I'm not talking about natural language, not talking about song or video or pictures, because that's different. But at least with respect to code, everybody is protected. But if they're not convinced of that, that is where that duplicate detection comes in. That middle layer we call technical mitigation. Having that duplicate detection filter set to block, where it's blocking out any suggestions that are 65 lexemes or longer, matching something that already exists, ensures that what you're getting at the time you get it is either unique to you, or it's so short that it can't be protected. It's going to be one of those two things. And so that is our main mitigation internally, because when we use it at GitHub, use it at Microsoft, we don't want to risk having that type of code added to the code base. So we have that filter set to block, so that way we're not getting those outputs back. If for some reason that middle layer fails, so the microservice crashes or there's a bug in how we've engineered it or something like that, you move to the top layer of the cake, which is the indemnity protection in your contract. So in the baseline agreements that customers have with Microsoft and with GitHub, we have always indemnified the use of our products and services. If you're using it, someone sues you and says your use of it violates their intellectual property, we will protect customers for that. With Copilot, we extended that even further. So Microsoft has what they call the customer copyright commitment. GitHub has, we call it something different, but it's the same thing, where we're not only protecting your use of Copilot, we are also protecting the outputs from Copilot. So if you take one of those outputs, you add it to your code base, you ship that to your customers, and you get sued, we will protect that as well. The only catch is, in order to get that protection, you have to have that duplicate detection filter turned on and set to block. So that will actually be in the product terms. You have to have that particular filter turned on.
Yeah.
And so our view is that, looking at the whole cake together, the law provides very low risk for users as a baseline. But then that technical mitigation reduces that risk to practically zero. And if for some reason you get struck by lightning, where something has happened and you're getting sued anyway, the indemnity and the contract will help protect you.
Yeah, and then it really sounds like the way we worked before Copilot, that is first Google, then go to Stack Overflow and copy-paste some code, that seems almost more dangerous than using Copilot in the way you're explaining it.
Yes.
Yeah.
If you have what we call, it's called shadow IT. Like if you have people going to Stack Overflow or even just going to a repository, like they find a code they like in a public repo and they just, you know, take a dependency, fork it, copy it, whatever, that's a risk.
Yeah.
So for example, we've got functionality that customers, it's an option. So instead of having your duplicate detection filter set to block, we have, it's kind of like an inform functionality where you allow the suggestion to come in. And if there's a match, it will flag certain repositories where it matches. And so what we have found from the beta testing of that is that when you're getting a match, it's rare. Like you're only getting a match about 1% of the time. And that 1% is heavily weighted towards new files. So there's no context to individualize the response. Or it's something that's universally implemented. So think of like common regular expressions, the quicksort algorithm, stuff that everybody does the same way. And what we have found from using that beta functionality, this code inform code reference functionality, is that a lot of code that is a match has tons of uses across dozens or hundreds of repositories, and the licenses conflict. So you'll have something that was released under an MIT license earlier in time. A developer somewhere copied that, put it in their own project that was GPL'd, and now that particular output, is that under a GPL license or an MIT license? You know, trying to figure that out is not really possible. And that is the baseline from before generative AI. It just happens that this functionality has shown a spotlight on what developers were already doing. They want low friction reuse of other code that works, but they also want to get credit for their particular code. And that just, you know, human nature has led to a real mess in code bases. And so you're almost more secure having this extra service on the side, screening out the stuff that already matches. And then if you've got something that you want to do that is universally implemented and you can't get a response from Copilot because all the different iterations have already been done, at that point, you can go try and find something or do it yourself, but you kind of know what you're getting into.
Hmm.
Whereas for everything else, what you're getting is either short enough that you don't have to worry about the legal risks, or it's unique to you at the time you get it.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're starting to run out of time a little bit, but I have one, not really a question, but when I do these workshops and they have not already bought Copilot, it's like they're waiting for some sort of AI policy being implemented in the company. And I'm, when someone asks me what I think about those kind of topics, I go blank. I have nothing to add, I feel. Can you help me and also help our listeners to think, like, what would a good AI policy be and why do they need it? Do they even need it?
Yep. So GitHub has a template policy that we put together almost a year ago now. And so if customers want to see that, they are welcome to ask kind of their account representative and we'll pass it to them. But one of the interesting things is that you don't really need anything that sophisticated. You don't have to change what you're already doing. So if you look, for example, and let me see if I can find it while we're on here. Microsoft has its own set of internal policies and use guidelines. And they're very sparse. They're very limited in terms of what it says. Essentially, it's you're responsible for your own code. So treat it as normal software development lifecycle stuff. Keep doing your linting, your code reviews, all of those types of things. If you see anything that's potentially wrong, flag it. Don't use it for anything classified. And that's really it. I mean, that's really kind of the own stuff that we follow on our end, using our own internal guidelines. There's not anything that's particularly different. And again, remember, this is for something that is enabled by default for everybody at both companies. Yeah. GitHub doesn't have anything Copilot specific. We have zero Copilot specific policies that we created. It's just we have a pre-existing software development lifecycle that is very well tested, and we just run Copilot code through that. So if a customer wants a policy, we can give them the framework for a policy. We can do that. Just go ahead and ask your account rep and we'll send you the template that GitHub put together. But you really don't need one as long as you are already following good practice with the development of your code. If you're already doing linting, you're already doing static and dynamic security testing, you're already doing those things where a developer is seeing what's going into the code base, Copilot isn't creating new risk. It's just speeding up what you're already doing.
Yeah.
I have one last thing before we end. And this doesn't necessarily need to be related to AI and diverse and things that GitHub does. It could be just AI in general. But laws, as they are written today, may not always be suited to the type of technology that we have. Like in the US, because that's where you're active, what are like the first one or two laws that probably needs to be some sort of somehow rewritten to sort of better fit the technology landscape that we have today?
That is a loaded question. So the United States law around copyright and privacy are a mess, particularly compared to Europe. So if you look, for example, Europe, you all have GDPR as your baseline. The EU AI Act, you know, once that's finalized next month, that is going to be kind of the benchmark for AI.
Yep.
In the United States, we don't have technology-based laws. They're instead industry-based laws. So if you look, for example, at privacy, we have laws that govern healthcare. We have laws that govern telemarketing. It's all very siloed. Yep. And so because of that, it creates a mess federally, our national government, trying to parse out what applies. And then each of our 50 individual states will try and pass laws addressing gaps. And then we have a whole wide area of law on what is called preemption, whether or not a state law gets preempted by what our national government has done. And so it's a mess. Like here in the United States, it's a mess. There's no better way of saying that. In terms of trying to address it, so California, our largest state, has a privacy act that they tried to get close-ish to GDPR.
Okay.
And so we're trying to accommodate that, and having to make sure that AI works under that model is going to be one of the points that our policy team focuses on. The other thing that's going to need to change is the Copyright Act, potentially. So as the law exists now, it's very protective for AI in pretty much all circumstances. But a lot of folks don't like that. Like, that might make sense for code. Does that make sense for images and video? I don't know. Like, that's, it's just something that I'm not comfortable with. As a technology guy, it just makes me squeamish. But that's there's no way for that to change unless our legislature changes the Copyright Act, which hasn't really been amended since before I was born. They just kind of leave it alone and let the Copyright Office, you know, offer guidance and let the courts make their decisions. So there's a lot. AI is going to be a new field. It's something that all of the politicians and both of our main political parties are interested in trying to regulate. But most of these folks are not technologically savvy. And most of them are very old. I mean, I don't want to be ageist, but, you know, if you don't have a tech background and you're in your 70s and 80s, it's a challenge to explain a lot of these concepts in a way that they understand.
Yeah, and I think so it's something you can see when you watch or congressional hearings, you know, sometimes it's such a gap between the person asking the questions and the person that's trying to answer the questions.
Yeah, it's like there's a really funny example where when the hearing about TikTok and the congressman was like, do the TikTok app access your home Wi-Fi? Like, that would be the worst thing in the world. It's like, well, yeah.
That's how you get to the internet. Yes. Yeah.
It's like a huge privacy.
We had a congressman in a hearing ask the CEO of Google why he could not do things on his iPhone. Yeah. And the guy's like, you need to talk to Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple. Like, it's embarrassing, man. Like, it's particularly as me coming from the tech background and being in law, I like laws in general, watching the lawmakers totally flub the technology. Yeah.
And it's a little bit scary that these are the people that write the laws when they clearly don't understand the topic.
But something I really, speaking of congressional hearings, I watched the one where Sam Altman and there was a woman from IBM and one more person called, and it was about AI. I don't remember his name, but he said that what he did not want to do was to fail the way they failed with social media, where they failed to protect the children, that children got exploited and used on social media. And that was his biggest fear, that we don't want to do that. And I think that was, you know, that seems very reasonable to have that standpoint, that we want to protect the children. We don't want this type of technology to exploit children.
If that's what they actually want to do. The issue is that a lot of people have no regard for the children, and they will come up with really bad ideas that they will say is to protect the children.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of become the rallying cry. So it's going to be an interesting few years. Like, you know, I think Europe is where the hot activity is. The AI Act passing, the AI Act implementing regulations over the next 2 years is going to have the biggest impact by far. But it's going to be interesting in the United States as well.
Yeah. We have a politician in the EU from Sweden that kind of does that. I say we need to protect children, but what her suggestion actually implies is that she wants to end end-to-end encryption. So it does not compute.
We get exactly
the paradox.
Right.
Yes.
Well,
they're too smart for us.
Thank you so much for talking to us. This was a really interesting conversation, and I'm sure that so many will find this useful.
It's my pleasure. Thank you all for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much, Greg. And thank you to everyone that has been listening. Have a great Monday or whatever day you're listening to this in the week, and see you soon.
Du har lyssnat på Microsoft Partnerpodden, en podd om Microsoft Sverige med mig, Adam Palm.
Och mig, Johan Nordberg. Som vanligt hittar du länkar och resurser på aka.ms/partnerpodden.
Maila oss gärna på partnerpodden@microsoft.com.